From Austin Film Festival, this is On Story, a look inside the creative process from today's leading writers, filmmakers, and creators. I'm your host, Barbara Morgan. This week on Story, we'll hear from legendary independent filmmaker Roger Corman, whose extensive body of work includes over 500 film credits.
I think that horror is a genre that has appealed forever and will always because simply of the psychological makeup of the human mind.
And later, we'll hear from writer and director Nicole Holofcener on her films Please Give, The Land of Steady Habits, and Enough Said.
I trust the mess that I'm going to make in a first draft. I feel like just get to the end of the draft, and it's so much easier to go back.
On Story from Austin Film Festival, we'll be back in a moment. This is On Story from Austin Film Festival. I'm your host, Barbara Morgan. Roger Corman is a trailblazer in the world of independent filmmaking. Often called the Pope of Pop Cinema, Corman opted out of the major studio system early on by founding his own production and distribution company, New World Pictures, in 1970. His extensive film credits include cult classics, The Wild Angels, Little Shop of Horrors, The Trip, and The Intruder. Corman is also widely known for mentoring a number of filmmakers, including James Cameron, Gail Ann Hurd, Francis Ford Coppola, Jonathan Demme, and Ron Howard. Roger Corman spoke about his 50-year career with producer Barry Josephson at the Austin Film Festival, where he was receiving the Extraordinary Contribution to Filmmaking Award.
Your moniker, the way you're known, is the Pope of Pop Cinema. And I think that that is so true and so valid. And the last time I sat down like this was with Jonathan Demme, who's one of the filmmakers that you helped foster and whose career you helped foster. And I just want to read some of those filmmakers. Francis Ford Coppola was an assistant of yours. Ron Howard was given his first film by you. Jonathan Demme, John Sayles, James Cameron, Robert Towne, who wrote Chinatown, Peter Bogdanovich, another assistant, correct? Curtis Hanson, Martin Scorsese, Joe Dante and Alan Arkush, who I think cut trailers for you, right?
That's where they started.
Got it. You went to Stanford for civil engineering. I want to take you back, if that's okay, because I think everybody's interested in people's origin stories. You went and got a job right afterwards. You started on a Monday, you finished on a Thursday, and you quit. What did you tell your boss when you quit?
I was an engineering major at Stanford, and I found out that the film critics for the Stanford Daily got free passes to all the theaters in Palo Alto. So I wrote a sample review, and they took me on. And I then started looking at films more critically, and I came to the conclusion I really wanted to get into films. Also, I just wanted to get out, so I just took the degree and moved on. And I was getting nowhere in motion pictures, and finally I thought, well, the hell with it. I'm an engineer. I'll get a job as an engineer. And I started at U.S. Electrical Motors and on Monday, and on Thursday I just went into the personnel office and said, this is all a big mistake. And they said, well, think about it, Roger. Stay over the weekend and make your decision on Monday. And I said, you know, I really can't come back tomorrow. I'm leaving now.
Thank God that happened, or 400 movies wouldn't have been made and many careers not made. You went for English literature to Oxford University.
Yes, that was after the Navy. I finally got a job as a messenger at Fox and worked my way up to being a reader in the story department. And the head of the story department called me in one time, and he said, you know, you are the only reader here who has never given a positive review to anything. You said no to every single script or story we've sent you. And I said, that's because I'm the new guy. You give me all the rotten stuff. Give me something that's decent. And they gave me a script called The Big Gun. I knew they were looking. They had a commitment with Gregory Peck. It was one of those pay-or-play things. If he didn't work before a certain time, they had to pay him anyway. So I wrote notes on it, and it became The Gunfighter with Gregory Peck starring. And the head of the story department got a bonus for my notes, and I said, that's it, I'm out of here. And I had some time left on the GI Bill, so I figured I wanted to go to Europe, and so I went to Oxford.
And you lived in Paris for a while, too, and had some influences there. I think at New World, you were the first person to sort of give foreign filmmakers their distribution releases in America, like Fellini and Truffaut.
I had always loved the works of the auteurs, for lack of a better word. And I started A New World in 1970 as a production distribution company. And we were doing very well with our American, you can use the word exploitation. Some people don't like that word, but I'll accept it. Exploitation and other types of action and horror films. And I heard that Bergman, as many filmmakers, had an argument with Svensk Film Industry, which were distributing his films. So he had to show that a great artist can be a smart businessman as well. He financed Cries and Whispers totally himself. And then he worked out a plan whereby in distribution, you normally assign a certain percentage as just a starting point to each country. Now, we'd never distributed Arthouse films, but I took the film sight unseen. And he said, simply because I wanted to distribute it, he sent me word back. He accepted it, but he insisted that I look at it, and if I didn't like it, I could change my mind. But of course, I loved it, and it was a great film.
Those early moments of doing things on a shoestring and, you know, raising $12,000 for your first movie, it seems like you didn't really feel comfortable working for someone else, that you wanted to make your own path work.
Well, at that time, Hollywood was more highly unionized than it is today, and it was very, very difficult to break in. And when I came back from Europe, I started writing spec scripts, and I finally sold one for $3,000, and I asked the producer if I could go along and work for him for nothing to learn what he was doing, and if I could get an associate producer credit, because I realized the importance of credits, and he said yes. So with the $3,000, I could set myself up as an independent producer, and I borrowed money from a number of the guys in my engineering class at Stanford and made the first picture for $12,000. And I chose a science fiction subject because I knew you didn't need names for that type of film, and I obviously couldn't afford one. So I made an underwater monster film called It Stalked the Ocean Floor. And the Lippert Releasing, a small company, picked it up, and they thought my title was too arty, so they changed the title to Monster from the Ocean Floor, and it did very well. So I took the money from that, and I was always interested in car racing, and I made a picture called The Fast and the Furious, which started American International. And also, I scored twice on that. The film itself was successful, and then I sold the title to Universal, and they've done very well with that title.
Don't you think? Think about legacy. Think about that. It's mind-boggling. And at AIP, you meet Sam Markoff, and he didn't spend a lot of money on movies. But it seems like you were prepared for that. because you'd done things on a shoestring. Tell me just about that early interaction, about just his policy, the way you worked. What kind of influence was that, and how hard was that?
Well, how I started with him was this. I had done The Fast and the Furious, and it was a pretty good picture shot in 2 weeks. And I had offers from a couple of secondary studios, but I realized the trap for an independent producer was that you invest in film, you make a film, you go into distribution, and you have to wait 6 months or a year for the money to come back so you can make your next film. And Sam Markoff and Jim Nicholson were starting what they originally called American Releasing and then changed to American International. And they wanted to take the film. And they had a certain amount of financing. And I said, I'll give you this film, which is a film that started AIP, but what I want is a three-picture deal. This is the first picture, I'll make two more, and anticipating what Ingmar Bergman, I never thought of that before, the same concept. I said, when I make the film, I want you to pay me back my negative cost, and then we'll go into distribution, and I can then go immediately into the next film. And they agreed to that, and that was a formula that worked very well for AIP and for me.
You know, when we all look at movies like Blumhouse and so on, and Hanging in the Blumhouse conference room is one of your movies, The Terror, he went with a formula of genre movies, less than $5 million, no holds barred, that's what I'm going to do. And I think that that formula has really served him well, and I think he's taken a page out of your playbook. You once said that these movies, that kind of movie, genre, horror, sci-fi, that these genres will last. They will find an audience always, and it seems to be true, whether it's you starting out in the 50s or, you know, right to today. I mean, we just had Halloween open, reimagined version of it that did incredibly well. Why do you think that is? Why do you think sci-fi, horror, suspense movies, the kind of movies that you made groundbreaking, still last, still work? What did you learn about the genre early on that made you want to be so prolific in it?
Well, particularly with horror, I think it's a psychological concept. I think the baby, the small child, hears thunder and sees lightning and sees the monster under the bed, and the parents say there's no monster under the bed, and eventually he realizes there is none. But I think it's the thought is still there in our unconscious, and I think that horror is a genre that has appealed forever and will always, because simply of the psychological makeup of the human mind. There's something similar with science fiction, but it takes you more into imagination. We all imagine, we dream of things, and science fiction again hits a psychological point in the mind. So I think these are concepts that are universal and timeless.
On Story is part of a growing number of programs in Austin Film Festival's On Story project, including the On Story PBS series, the On Story radio program and podcast, and the On Story book series. To find out more about On Story and Austin Film Festival, visit onstory.tv or austinfilmfestival.com. On Story from Austin Film Festival will be back in a moment. This is On Story from Austin Film Festival. I'm your host, Barbara Morgan. We're back with filmmaker Roger Corman. When we left off, Corman was discussing writing in the horror and sci-fi genre and collaborating with well-known filmmakers throughout his extensive career. Clips of Dementia 13 and The Wild Angels, courtesy of Roger Corman Productions and American International Pictures. Clip of The Intruder, courtesy of Film Group, Inc. and Astor Pictures Corporation.
You have a great career of directing movies. House of Usher, The Terror, Machine Gun Kelly, The Wild Angels, St. Valentine's Massacre, which I loved. I must have watched the movie over and over again. Bloody Mama. You had so many opportunities to produce or direct. Produce or direct. You were developing material always. You were working with new writers. You were working with auteurs. You were having your staff direct pieces of movies and so on. You had a system, it seems. From that, so many great filmmakers and writers you brought forward. When you were running that system, when you were working that system, and you decided to direct or produce or to bring someone forward to directing, what was your decision-making process? What pieces of material did you really want to do and why?
Well, that started in 1970. Up until I made my first film, I think in 56 or something like that, and I was an independent producer-director only until 1970, when I decided to start my own production and distribution company, New World. And I had already worked with young people. For instance, Francis Coppola got his first job. I had bought some Russian science fiction films, and I hired him out of UCLA when he, film school when he graduated. And his first job was cutting the anti-American propaganda out of Russian science fiction films. And he went on to be my assistant and then did his first directorial job for me.
Let's stick with Francis for a second, because I mean, that was his first film for you, Dementia 13?
Dementia 13.
And how did that come to be?
I was doing a Grand Prix Formula One racing picture in Europe, and we were traveling around with the circuit, and I had bought a Volkswagen microbus, and Francis and Chuck Hannawalt, a grip who always worked with me, actually rebuilt the microbus so it had shell and various compartments inside and compartments on the roof, in which we put all our equipment. So it was essentially a mini traveling studio. And as we were finishing, or shortly before we were finishing, I thought I had to go back to Europe to direct another film, but I thought, I've got a crew here, which is a very small crew, and we've got the microbus. We could make another picture. And so I suggested it to Francis, and he wrote a treatment, and I said yes. And I remember our last picture, our last race, was the British Grand Prix in Liverpool. And we couldn't shoot a feature film in England because of certain labor requirements. As a matter of fact, we got in there on a fake application. We said we were shooting a documentary about racing. But I said, across the Irish Channel, there's no such rule. You can just take the microbus and put it on a ferry and go from Liverpool to Dublin, and Francis did, and he made Dementia 13. Actually, we called the picture Dementia, and while we were editing, we found out that here's how you jump around a little bit. We found out there was a picture called Dementia. We couldn't use the title, but we really liked it. And I came up with an idea one time, the unlucky number 13, and I called Francis in the editing room, and I said, Francis, can you loop, which you know it means to add a dialogue, can you loop in something that the killer had a traumatic experience as a child at the age of 13? And Francis said, yeah, I can do that.
Ever since Kathleen died, my mother's been running around with some sort of crazy guilt, looking at every one of us, trying to put it on one of our heads. Billy was only 13, 2 months after it happened. He used to wake up in the middle of the night and come screaming into my room because he had nightmares about her. He My own father died with his wife refusing to see him. Now I feel it's been passed on to me. I've got to wait. I've got to watch. Until I can make some sense out of all this.
So that's how the title came about.
Well, I guess it was 65 or 66 when you made Wild Angels. And it felt like it was a brilliant movie in its time, and it was a big time of independent filmmaking. Studio system really had a grip, and now it felt like in the 60s, you know, there were these movies that were independent movies that were successful at the box office. You know, later comes Easy Rider and so on. Like, what did it mean to you how well received that movie was, how much money it made? You know, can you tell us a little bit about making that movie and what it was like for you as a filmmaker?
Well, I'd been making a series of Edgar Allan Poe pictures. I think I made five or six of them. And I was meeting with Sam and Jim Nicholson, and they wanted me to make another Poe picture. And I felt I was starting to repeat myself and I had nothing more to say on that subject. And I was aware of the beginning of the counterculture in the early 60s, and I said, I don't want to make another Poe picture. I want to leave the studios. I want to go out in the streets. And Sam said, what do you want to make? And the Hell's Angels were getting a huge amount of publicity at that time, and I felt a picture about the Hell's Angels was meaningful to me. It was a rebellion of the underclass, which is something was still with us, probably will be with us for some time. And I felt here was a chance to do a film about something that I felt was significant, and at the same time, I thought this would be commercial.
Yeah, we don't want nobody telling us what to do. We don't want nobody pushing us around.
Yeah. I apologize. But tell me, just what is it that you want to do?
Well, we want to be free. We want to be free to do what we want to do. We want to be free to ride. And we want to be free to ride our machines without being hassled by the man. And we want to get loaded. And we want to have a good time. That's what we're gonna do.
Well, when, baby? Let's go.
We're gonna have a good time. We're gonna have a party.
Yeah! And this is the way we worked at that time. They said yes, and we shook hands, and I made the picture. We didn't even have a contract until I was in post-production on that film.
It's interesting when I think about people who came through your process. I mean, on The Godfather, everything I've read about it, everything I've seen about it, every interview with Francis, you know, it wasn't like they gave him a ton of money. It wasn't like they gave him everything in the world. So he had to really be resourceful and think it out and figure it out. And I think he learned a lot from working with you. And obviously, I know that for sure from listening to Jim Cameron talk about you. You always seem to have that balance of creativity and also finding new actors, new people for your movies. You know, Bruce Dern, Robert De Niro, you know, people, filmmakers bringing, you know, people coming up in their careers. But you always did really balance it with how much can we afford and wanting to make these things for a price. Was that a drive to want to have profit?
Simply, I love the process of making films. I make films on two bases, which is what I think almost everybody does. One is the creativity and the desire to do good work, and the other is the fact that you want to make some money. And filmmaking really is, to me and to most of the people I know, a combination of those two elements. You want to make money, yet at the same time, you want to do good work. I would say there are three things I look for. Every writer, director, or producer I know who's been successful over a period of time has been intelligent. Maybe you can be a dummy and have one hit, but you're not going to have two. For a long career, every one of these men and women are intelligent. The second It's hard work. It's really harder work than you think, particularly, as I say, for a director. Those two things you can judge fairly easily. The third is creativity, and that you're sort of guessing, sort of the educated guess. Your information, your background, gives you a thought, but you're not positive. So it is the educated guess, and it's the educated guess with these people. Generally, they start as an assistant. For instance, Francis Coppola started as an assistant, as did Jonathan Demme and a number of others. Other times, for instance, Marty Scorsese, you mentioned, I had seen an underground film he had made in New York, and I met him somewhere, and I was just very impressed with him. And AIP wanted me to make a sequel to Bloody Mama, which had been a success, but I said, I've now got my own company. I don't want to, I'll produce it, but I won't direct it. And I thought about Marty, and he's one of the few that I just signed as a director without having worked with him before. I made the educated guess based on the underground film, and just talking to him, he was intelligent, and I felt, yes, he has the ability.
I have to say that having faith in people's vision has been sort of standard for me, and I think that's a little bit of me having an educated guess. That for me is the thing, seeing that person's vision and knowing that they can complete it and they can change it, you know, so that educated guess. I do want to say that anybody who has not read How I Made 100 Movies and Never Lost a Dime, it's a book you must read. It's remarkable, and it really talks a lot about, from Roger's perspective, the construction of making movies. It's like a conversation. It's wonderful.
The title was given to me by the publisher, and I told him I've made more than 100 films, and I've lost occasionally. And they said, the editor said, has all the advertising on all of your pictures said exactly what was in the film? And I said, call the book anything you want.
You once said to Ron Howard, if you do a good job for me, you'll never have to work for me again.
That's true. I did tell him that. It wasn't, you'll never have to work with me again. You never will work with me again. What I meant was, if you do a good job, you're jumping immediately to big budget films.
What did you see in these people, right, in terms of mentoring them?
Well, at any point, you've got to say Jim Cameron.
Was Jim art directing?
And he was doing special effects.
Special effects,
and
right.
As a matter of fact, on this business of how brilliant Jim Cameron is, we were doing, ended up being head of half the company there, and he had designed and built a spaceship. And I was going over the spaceship with him the afternoon before shooting, although I'd been there before. And I remember there was one corridor in the spaceship that was just totally flat. And I told him I liked in art 1A, articulation of the surface, to break up the surface, because there anything he could do. He said, come tomorrow morning when we're about to shoot, you'll see the breaking up of the surface. I saw it, and it was great. It was filled with dials and all kinds of pseudo-technical things protruding from the walls. And I said, Jim, this is great. How'd you do it so quickly overnight? He said, I bought a number of McDonald's hamburger containers, and I painted them in a gunmetal way and glued them to the walls, and I know that we have a budget problem. It costs $12. And the point I'm stumbling around trying to make is, the man who had the creativity to solve on a low-budget picture a problem for $12 is the same man who had the creativity to take $100 million or more and make a huge, brilliant film. I see
so many $100 million films, and so have you, and you say, where did the money go? I don't see this on the screen. And as I say, you can see the ability there on one level that predicted directly what he was able to do on a higher level.
When you look back on it, do you feel like you have, is there one film that you truly felt the most joy or triumph about?
Maybe The Intruder. It was a film about the integration of schools in the South in 1960, in which I, for the lead, I took a new young actor, Bill Shatner, who had been on Broadway, and it was his first film.
I'll tell you something right here and now. It may be hot tonight, but it's going to get hotter for a whole lot of people. This here little town's going to burn. What I mean, it's going to burn the conscience of the country and put forth a light that everyone and everybody's going to see and feel. This town I'm talking about, Caxton. Yeah! People, something happened today. 10 Negroes went into the Caxton High School and sat with the white children there. Nobody stopped them. But he turned them out. And you know what they're saying? That means they're saying that you all don't give a darn whether the whites mix with the blacks because you didn't fight against it.
It got wonderful reviews, and it won a couple of minor film festivals, but it was the first film that I ever made that lost money. I couldn't believe that I'd lost money, but I learned something from that. Two things. Maybe I was too serious. Maybe I was lecturing to the audience and had forgotten that a motion picture, even if you have something serious to say, there must be some entertainment within it. And I modified my work after that. But I'm still very proud of that film.
The last 50 years, which movies would you say are revolutionary?
Two pictures, I would say. They were, neither one was revolutionary, but Jaws took a concept that had been made as a low-budget type of film, the creature from the ocean floor, in this case, sharks, and turned it into a major film which changed a portion of the motion picture industry. And I remember when I saw Jaws, I said to John Davison, who went on to be a major producer himself, we are in trouble. The major studios have figured out not only what we, but other low-budget filmmakers have done. And a year or two later, out came Star Wars. And I remember saying to John, if we were in trouble before, we're in bigger trouble now. Those two films, while not being revolutionary, really changed a giant portion of the film industry.
On Story from Austin Film Festival, we'll be back in a moment.
We'll be right back.
This is On Story from Austin Film Festival. I'm your host, Barbara Morgan. Nicole Holofcener has written and directed 6 feature films, including Friends with Money, Enough Said, and most recently, The Land of Steady Habits. In 2019, Holofcener was nominated for an Academy Award for Best Adapted Screenplay for her script, Can You Ever Forgive Me? In addition to her feature work, Holofcener has directed numerous television shows, including Orange is the New Black, Togetherness, One Mississippi, and the upcoming HBO series, Mrs. Fletcher. Holofcener spoke with Pixar's head of creative development, Mary Coleman, at the Austin Film Festival. Clips of Please Give, courtesy of Sony Pictures Classics, Inc.
I wanted to jump right in to the thing that you are best known for and that people know is most compelling about your movies, and that is your very human, very messy characters. And I want, just to quote Albert from Enough Said, I don't know if you all remember when Ava, who's played by Julia Louis-Dreyfus, goes to say to Albert, you know, after she's really screwed him and hurt him, and she says, I didn't know the right thing to do. And he looks her in the eye and said, you knew the right thing to do, you just didn't do it. And I feel like that sums up a lot of your main characters that are these, not just flawed, but truly messy characters that often they know the right thing, they just don't do it.
Well, I think some of them are more f***ed up than others. And some are just screwed up like all of us in a normal way. I just go with what feels like if it's over the top, it's too much. I might write a scene where a character who's losing it and all they do is like flop on the bed, you know? Or I can't think of an example, of course, right now, but flawed characters or really screwed up characters, they don't break plates in their kitchen. Do you know what I mean? Like when I see movies like that a lot, like big histrionics and stuff.
I know that in Hollywood, there's a lot of pressure. They toss around the words likable and appealing for main characters. Uh-huh. And I find your characters lovable, but I don't always like what they're choosing and what they're doing. Have you had pressure from producers or studios to make your characters more likable?
My goal is obviously to make even unlikable people three-dimensional or that we can have some compassion for them. You know, short of like a serial killer, I don't have to do that. But with my problems, my character's little problems, I think a lot of them are forgivable.
Well, and I feel like you write with a lot of compassion for your characters. I read scripts for a living, and I read a lot of scripts lately. There's a trend toward these kind of mean-spirited tone toward the characters. And even when your characters are making wrong choices, I always feel your compassion for them, and that gives me compassion for them. And you have a whole range. You have from the cringeworthy choices in Please Give, like offering food to a man that the main character thinks is homeless, and it turns out he was just waiting in line for a restaurant.
Wait a second. Excuse me, sir. Are you hungry? Would you like this?
I'm waiting for a table.
I'm sorry, I really am.
I'm so sorry. Really, we're very
Please
sorry.
Forgive me.
Are you out of your mind?
He looked homeless.
He looked like a black man waiting for a table.
Definitely cringeworthy. To the irresponsible and illegal statutory rape, or at least that's what the police accuse your main character of. And they're not always guilty, but these characters, they do things that it's like watching a train wreck in slow motion sometimes. Uh-huh. 5 out of 6 of your movies have starred the amazing Catherine Keener. And I would love to hear how that relationship started and what the collaboration has been.
Well, I saw Catherine in this movie by Tom DiCillo called Johnny Suede with Brad Pitt a long time ago. And I just, you know, I was looking to cast Walking and Talking for many years because I hadn't made a feature yet. So I really wanted Joan Cusack, but she was at the height of her Working Girl, you know, that other movie that she's so good in. Anyway, and I couldn't even get her agent to talk to me or read my script. And then I saw Catherine and I just was like, that's my girl. She's just so unique and gorgeous, but in a, you know, she's awkward and funny and intelligent, and it's all on her face. And I went up to her at the Stairmaster at the gym, and I said, can I send my script to your agent? And she said, yes, and we met and had a laugh. And then we met, and that was that. It was like we had a great lunch. She's incredibly warm and funny, and hadn't starred in a movie, and was happy to do it. And then 6 short years later, we got the movie made. And then I wrote the part in Lovely and Amazing for her in mind, hopefully she would want to do it, and she did. And kind of the same, like I think in Friends with Money, I asked her what character she wanted to play, and she chose the character she did. I didn't want her to play Jennifer Aniston's character because she's much younger and it seemed more appropriate. But I don't know, our collaboration is weird. Like usually when I'm directing an actor, I try to stay out of their eye line, you know, because I'm reacting like, and usually with Catherine, I'm like, okay, I'm moved. And yet she wants me in her eye line, like as security. Because we're good friends, and I really understand her, and she really understands me. And, you know, I haven't had an actor want that, you know, just the support.
Your scripts have attracted some really great actors, and I can see why. It gives them a lot to sink their teeth into. Your characters are so dimensional. I mean, just to name a few, we mentioned Julia Louis-Dreyfus. Enough Said has a beautiful performance by James Gandolfini. You had the very young Jake Gyllenhaal in Lovely and Amazing, Emily Mortimer, and just really great actors want to work on your material. You also require them to go really vulnerable. I mean, the most extreme case is Emily Mortimer mm-hmm. standing naked in front of another character and saying, "Assess my body." And I think that was such a powerful scene because it wasn't at all sexual. It was naked in the deepest sense of someone just stripped down, and it was riveting to watch. And I wonder, have you ever had an actor, you know, excited to sign on board, but then have trouble going vulnerable?
No, I mean, the actors that I've cast are so clearly incredible, you know, when I get them, that I don't have to do that much. I think there might have been one time. Yeah, in Please Give, when Rebecca Hall comes to tell Catherine Keener that her grandma died, and Keener's been crying at the sink because she's so miserable, and Rebecca comes in and then they hug, and I remember Rebecca was very held back and not crying. And not that she, for whatever reason, you know. And I did have to coach her, you know, I think I had Catherine maybe say a couple of things like, oh, baby, like take a motherly thing off camera. I mean, when you couldn't see Catherine's face in the shot. And then, you know, eventually Rebecca kind of fell apart.
Are you all right?
Yeah, I'm just, I guess washing dishes just makes me want to kill myself. Oh, God, I'm so sorry.
I know. I just wanted to tell you that my grandma died.
Come inside, please.
Do you think you could die if you ate something from a dented can?
You think that's what happened? I don't think so.
Oh. No, I've just been taking care of her for a really long time, you know. This pill that day, this doctor, that medicine, not that medicine, and then she dies from drinking bad juice.
That didn't happen.
Wow, it's my favorite of your movies.
Oh, thanks.
I love that movie. And I love that scene because you have the character that Catherine Keener plays, spends the whole movie comedically and sometimes tragically trying to do good. And she says she's warped by guilt, and that's what the movie's, a lot of it is about. And then in this unexpected moment, she does do good. She helps this young woman in that moment of emotion. She's just there for her, and it's a in the title, Please Give, like this woman is looking for a way to give back. And she finds it in that simple moment in seeing this woman's grief.
And she buys her kid $200 jeans.
And she buys her kid $200 jeans, which is a different kind of giving. But
it was emotionally giving to that child.
It was. Her daughter's miserable at that point, and she realizes doing this extravagant thing is going to make my kid really happy. So it's not the volunteering at the Center for Kids with Down Syndrome where the character breaks down crying in front of them and has to be asked to leave. And it's not all of the other sort of bleeding heart liberal ways that she tries to do good. Your main characters often don't have a clear goal. Sometimes they're very aimless, and sometimes they create their own obstacles. Yeah. Sometimes by the end of the movie, they haven't completely overcome them. Mm-hmm. So how do you approach structure mm-hmm. with a movie like that?
Well, I am really bad at structure. And I went to film school, and I bought the Sid Field book. There's probably 100 more now, right? How to write a script in 5 minutes, you know? I was told to do outlines, and I did them in school, and then I did index cards, and by page 30, you have to know what the protagonist is up against, basically, and what he or she wants, and she has to have a strong want, and we have to know it, and all that makes sense. I get it. Those make for interesting movies, but I take notes. I come up with some characters I'm interested in, or a situation, and like in Please Give, you know, the situation with the apartments, you know, that was the first thing I thought of was, oh, they're waiting for this woman to die, and what would that be like if they were neighbors? And then I start writing the characters out in longhand, and I'll do that maybe for a couple of weeks. Like, this might happen, I take notes, and then I just start writing. And, because it gets boring doing that. Like, the outline sort of killed it for me. It's like, well, I already wrote it, you know? That's how it feels. I already figured what's gonna happen. So, you know, and that's, I think, a good thing and not so good sometimes, because I get very lost, you know? I don't know, I have to go back and think, well, what does this person want? But mostly, I don't think that. Mostly, it's intuitive, you know? And I trust the mess that I'm gonna make in a first draft. I feel like just get to the end of the draft. And it's so much easier to go back and see, oh, well, that sucks. Well, this is boring, you know? But until it's written, I don't know what it is. And sometimes I don't know how it's gonna end.
Even if you don't know the structure or the plot, are you heading yeah. toward where it lands?
Sometimes I have an idea for a last scene, which inevitably changes by the time I get there.
Let's talk a little bit about Land of Steady Habits. So it was a departure not only in having a male protagonist, it was your first movie without Catherine Keener, so I had a little withdrawal on that one. Mm-hmm.
Me too.
Was set in suburbia instead of urban. Your uh-huh. movies up until then have all been urban. It yeah. was an adaptation instead of your original script. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about some of the, how did those differences contribute to mm-hmm. a different experience?
The male protagonist thing was not really different because Ben is so, he didn't mind when I said this, so like a woman. And in terms of just his openness and vulnerability, sensitivity, generosity. Not that you fellas can't be that way. So it felt the same, and same with the younger guys. I think that there might have been less, you know, like when I'm working with a bunch of women, you know, we're in the dressing room together. We're talking about, you know, girl stuff. And that didn't happen, but it didn't matter. And the adaptation, you know, yeah, it wasn't a world that I was that familiar with, and I relied on the department heads to create, you know, the right outfits for these, like, sad people.
How did the author feel about the adaptation?
Well, it was a dream. He was thrilled. It was his first novel. He was already a fan of my movies and couldn't believe anyone was doing this, so I was very lucky. And he did give me notes. I asked for his opinion on drafts and then on cuts. But he was really respectful, and we were on the same taste level.
I want to talk about something that critics point out in your work, and that is how intimate the work is. And It's interesting because I never feel like a voyeur looking through a keyhole. I actually feel like a friend who's been invited into someone's bedroom. And so that the intimacy with those characters, when you get to the end of one of your movies, I feel like I've been through something with them. Uh-huh. And I really appreciate that your films have a sense of forgiveness and acceptance, and I often come out feeling like, it's gonna be okay. Mm-hmm. And is that something that when you're creating a film, do you consciously wanna land in a place of it's gonna be okay?
Somewhat, like a bittersweet okay.
Right, it's not gonna be perfect.
Right, like we don't know what's gonna happen to us, but maybe we've learned something. Maybe we've opened up just enough for a little bit. And that life goes on, but that, yeah, hopefully we learn things and can change a little. You want to have some kind of resolution, even if it's a small one. When I made Friends with Money, Sony Classics made it, and I don't know if you remember the ending, but I showed the cut, first cut, to the producers, the executives at Sony, and they said, where's the last reel? Like, you saw it. They didn't think it came to enough of a conclusion. And so I remember working on that. I don't remember what I did, but trying to feel more of a wrap-up, a resolution with people. And then eventually they were like, this is great, and we don't care. But yeah, it doesn't completely resolve. I am very similar to all of my characters. I feel, you know, I'm white, I'm privileged. It's what I know, and I usually will tell people it's right about what you know. I feel, you know, all the guilt is in there in all my movies, and I work on things I want to do, and I can't kind of fight that urge. And I thought, well, this story is still valuable to me. I love these people. I love this book. Okay, I hope it doesn't flop because of that. I'm inspired to write screenplays because I get all excited and worked up about some weird thing I saw somebody do or say, or I can't believe my friends are actually in this much denial and I can't wait to write it down, or, I'm inspired by the stuff I see and I want to get it out, I want to share it, I want to put my own perspective on it. And what makes a good screenplay? I don't know. I think authenticity makes a good movie, and knowing when to get in and out of scenes, and believability. Make your characters believable and say believable things. And there's so much good stuff I still would love to write about, but I like my friends too much.
On Story is brought to you in part by the Alice Kleberg Reynolds Foundation, a Texas family providing innovative funding since 1979. This project is supported in part by the Cultural Arts Division of the City of Austin Economic Development Department, the Texas Commission on the Arts, the U.S. Institute of Museum and Library Services, and the Texas Library and Archives Commission. This program is also made possible in part by a grant from Humanities Texas, the state affiliate for the National Endowment for the Humanities. On Story is supported in part by Too Far Media, immersive story experiences by Rich Chaparro. The show is produced by myself, Barbara Morgan. Our associate producers are Colin Heyer, Sonia McCarter, and Maya Perez. Our editors are Jamal Knox and Travis Neely. Audio capture by Travis Kennedy. Music by Brian Ramos. Production assistance comes from The Sound Lab, Inc., Travis Kennedy, and KUT 90.5 in Austin. Go to austinfilmfestival.com to find out more about Austin Film Festival and conference each October. Until next time, I'm Barbara Morgan, and this has been Austin Film Festival's On Story.